Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you, Tom Harkin. I don't have any better friend in the United States Senate than Tom Harkin, and I don't want to qualify the friendship in that way because I have very few individuals in any walk of life I consider as good a friend as Tom Harkin. We have worked together for a long time, and we're classmates, as he said, in the Senate. Tom and Ruth and Tipper and I have been very close for all these years, and I don't know what I can say that would add anything to what you already know, because he's a friend to all of you, and many of you have very close personal friendships with Tom, and you know, as I do, that you just can't have a better friend. And I really appreciate you, Tom. You fight for the people. You've got it right here in your heart. You come from the working class of this country. I watched what he did on that Americans with Disabilities Act, and I know the love he had for his brother and how that formed, and wow. And thank you very much. And to Governor Chet Culver and Mary Culver, thank you, Governor. You are a great leader for this state, and thank you for being on the job at all hours of the night and day, and for having the vision to look forward and to fight for these people that have given you their confidence. And I'm a huge fan. And thank you, by the way, for what you're doing on renewable energy. One of the great leaders among the governors in this country that has tackled this challenge, and I appreciate it. And Lieutenant Governor Patty Judge and former Senator John Judge, Patty, I would pay money. I'd pay a lot of money to watch you and listen to you debate Sarah Palin. There's just some way that we could arrange that. Why don't you call up Larry King? Leonard Boswell, God bless you, Vietnam veteran, my buddy, and Dodie, golly, I'm so glad to see you. And don't take anything for granted, but you're doing great, Leonard, and thank you for fighting for me and fighting for the Democratic Party and fighting for our country. Let's don't take anything for granted for Leonard Boswell. We appreciate you very much. And Bruce Braley and Dave Loebsack, I am so impressed with these two new members of Congress that you all sent from Iowa to the United States House of Representatives. They are shaking things up. They're eloquent. They're fighters. They're change agents. Their hearts are in the right place. They're doing a fantastic job. Congratulations on sending them there. And goodness, Becky Greenwald, let's make history and send the first woman from Iowa to the United States Congress. You can do it. It's going to happen. And Rob Hubler, what a great candidate in the 5th Congressional District. Let's make sure that Rob Hubler is elected as well. To all of your statewide elected officials, and many of these are very close friends of mine, Tom Miller and Holly, Mike Fitzgerald, and I'm happy to meet Susan, God bless you all, and Secretary of State Michael Morrow and Dorothy, and a special word of thanks to Scott Brennan for doing a terrific job as party chair, and to Liz, thank you. And don't forget the extreme importance of these legislative races. I'm very impressed with your new majority leader, Kevin McCarthy, and with the president of your Senate, Jack Kibbe, and let's make sure that we elect Democrats to the state house and to the state Senate in this election. I'm so glad to see my old friend Neil Smith here. And B, God bless you as well. Neil Smith, God, you're one of my heroes. Thank you, my friend. And Sally Peterson and Jim Autry, great to be with you all again. I owe a personal debt of gratitude to the to Reverend Milton Cole Duval for going way over the top on me and my family. I appreciated that. I never heard a blessing like that, but I hope somebody recorded it. Thank you, sir. Thank you. To all of the local elected officials, members of organized labor, teachers, all of the individuals here who make this state what it is and make our country what it is. And by the way, to Iowa generally, thank you for supporting me in the year 2000. Thank you for all that you have done for me. I am so grateful. God bless you. I'll never forget it. Never, ever, ever. Thank you. You'll sometimes hear the old cliche. Somebody will say, this is not my first rodeo. This is not my first Iowa JJ dinner. I remember coming to this dinner over the years. And I know that you have heard in the past, some people will come here and flatter you for the special role you play in America's political process. I mean it sincerely, and I'm not going to dwell on it because you've heard it many times, but I want you to know, as someone who has run in four national campaigns, twice for president, twice for vice president, as someone who has come here to all 99 counties, whose family members have gone around. My father, at the age of 80, went to all 99 counties in the state of Iowa. Some of you met him when he was traveling around. It is inspiring to see and feel the commitment and devotion that you have to American democracy. And again, I know you hear this, but it shouldn't go unsaid. And you played a special role this year. Once again, and you have a chance just 30 days and 23 and a half hours from now when the polls close to complete that special role that you started earlier this year to elect Barack Obama President of the United States of America and Joe Biden Vice President of the United States of America and bring change to this country. I was reminded of how many times I've come here. I remember in 1999 when this Jefferson Jackson Day dinner in Iowa played a critical and key role for me in my effort to win the Democratic nomination in 2000. I'll never forget that contest. I'll never forget coming back 2 years after that, not long after the terrible attacks of September 11th, 2001, when all Democrats in Iowa and around our country joined with all other Americans, put aside all partisanship, and we were united as one nation to respond to that attack. And I'm going to come back to that in just a moment because I don't think that our national leaders fully appreciated what they had at that moment in the form of national unity. I felt it in the JJ dinner here in Iowa in 2001. I remember when I came here to this dinner in 1997. You all will not remember this the way I do. I'm going to tell you a story most of you don't know. That was the year of the big blizzard. Were any of y'all here in 97 when it started snowing right early in the dinner? I'm going to tell you what was going on in the back of my mind that you didn't know anything about this. My two oldest daughters, Corinna and Kristen, challenged me a few months before that to run with them in the Marine Corps Marathon. And I said, I was much more of a runner then, and I'd run a few, 10-mile races, and I'd never run anything like that. And so I finally said, okay, I'll do it. And so I started training. For 4 months, I trained. And the Marine Corps Marathon was at 7 a.m., Eastern Standard Time on Sunday morning, the Sunday morning after I had already been invited and accepted to speak to the Iowa JJ dinner the Saturday night before them. And I figured, okay, I'll do the training, I'll get ready. Got Air Force Two, for goodness sake. It makes travel convenient. And so I'll finish up with the dinner, and I'll go out to the airport here in Des Moines and get on Air Force Two and get there, and I'll get my head on the pillow by midnight, and I'll get up at 6 a.m., and 6 hours sleep would be enough. Okay, we're in the dinner, and the snow picks up. And I'm sitting out here at one of those tables, and one of these military attachés comes in and says, "Sir, I have to tell you that the snow is so bad, Air Force Two's had to reposition in to Waterloo." Now, normally it's about a two-hour drive. In the snow, it's longer than that. So I'm thinking, uh-oh. So I get in the motorcade after the dinner, and it's a three-hour drive to Waterloo, and I'm thinking, okay, I get on the cell phone to Corinna and Chris and my daughters, and I'm thinking, okay, it can't be helped. Can't run a marathon on 3 hours sleep, and so they're going to give me a pass. Uh-uh, they say, "Suck it up, Dad." I got to my bed at 3 a.m., 6 a.m., the alarm clock ran. I will never forget that Iowa JJ dinner, I promise you. And y'all didn't know anything about it, but I remember. And that put some age on me, I'm telling you. I was reminded of that recently. I was in a restaurant, Tom, and I was sitting at the table, and a woman came walking by the front of the table, just staring at me as she walked by. And I didn't think anything about it until out of the corner of my eye, I saw the same woman coming from the opposite direction, just staring at me. And so I looked up and I said, "How do you do?" And she said, "You know, if you dyed your hair black, you would look just like Al Gore." I said, "Thank you, ma'am. So nice of you." She said, "You sound like him, too. The great impersonation." 8 years ago, in the election of 2000, our nation was enjoying prosperity. We had the largest budget surpluses in the history of the United States. Our economy was strong. We were dealing with the issues that always have to be attended to in healthcare and education and welfare reform and all of the different challenges that need a free democratic people to attend to. And we were making progress. And because we had made progress for 8 years, maybe that was one of the reasons why some were a little bit complacent and felt like maybe all that would continue no matter what happened. And you heard it too. I heard it. When people said, "It doesn't matter, these parties are so similar, the nominees of the parties aren't that different, it doesn't really matter that much who wins this election." Well, 8 years later, I don't hear anybody saying that elections don't matter. They know that that election mattered, and they know that this election matters, and that's why we've got to elect Barack Obama. We can't stand 4 more years of this. Take it from me, if that election had ended differently, we would not be bogged down in Iraq. We would have pursued bin Laden until we had captured bin Laden. We wouldn't have pulled the troops away and given up on that. We wouldn't be facing a self-inflicted economic crisis. We'd be fighting for middle-income families. We wouldn't be shredding the Constitution. We'd be standing up for the rights of every single American, regardless of religion or gender or sexual orientation or race. We'd be trying to live out the American dream. We wouldn't be denying the climate crisis. We'd be trying to solve the climate crisis. Elections matter, and this election matters a great deal to the future of this country. We need change more than I believe we have ever needed change. Again, a cliche that you have heard, but think about it for a moment. One of the purposes of representative democracy is to give the people of this country an opportunity to hold those who are exercising power in our behalf, to hold them accountable for what they do or what they fail to do. This is an opportunity to make our democracy work. If you believe that the last 8 years have been good for America. If you believe that our foreign policy and our economic policy and our civil liberties policy and our environmental policy and our health care policy and our education policy have all been handled extremely well, then you may want to reward the party in power by supporting the McCain-Palin ticket and these Republican nominees for the House and Senate. But before you do that, and I doubt seriously that many of you are in that posture, but I hope that my words will be heard beyond this room by those who are still undecided. Think for a moment about what has happened. Reflecting back on that moment in 2001, in the fall of 2001, after that dastardly and evil attack, when I met with so many of you at that JJ dinner and we were all unified, I had spent the previous week almost driving around Iowa by myself in a rented car. And I went to Middle Amana. I went to every part of the state. And I saw the flags out. And I talked with people. And everyone was of the same mind. We had to respond quickly. And we did go into Afghanistan, and that was the right thing to do. But then what happened? The person who had organized the attack against us, Osama bin Laden, the head of Al-Qaeda, was cornered and trapped in the mountains of Afghanistan in a place called Tora Bora. And at the time, there was some uncertainty in the public information about whether he was actually there or not. That uncertainty has been removed. He was there. And the intelligence made it clear at the time he was there. And he was in the caves. And he was well defended by this group of fanatics that follow him. And the United States Army and the Marines and the Air Force overhead had amassed forces. And the next day was when they were about to go in and get him. And overnight, word came from Washington to call off that assault and hold back. Keep him surrounded, but let the local militias go in and do the hard fighting there. They know the area. Why did they do that? I wondered at the time, having spent 8 years getting the daily intelligence briefings, having regular conversations with the CIA and military intelligence people about what was unfolding. I was surprised. I was upset. And I was curious. And to this day, I do not know why that assault was called off. But I do know this, that one day after the attacks of 9/11, the White House officials, including the Vice President, and apparently including the President, although there's not a direct report until a few days after that, but some of them, the very day after that attack, began to say, this is an ideal opportunity to use the anger of the nation to justify something that we've been wanting to do for other reasons, to invade Iraq and put bases in that oil-rich Persian Gulf region. Now, right away they began to agitate to send our troops to invade a country that had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with attacking us. Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. But they began to feed out the information to mislead people into believing that the person responsible for that attack was Saddam Hussein. I know you've heard this, but sometimes historically important events happen in our own lifetimes, and then they pass by and we forget them. But it's 31 days between now and the election in which we will hold accountable the people who, like John McCain, was cheerleading for this historic mistake that has put our country in such a bind. And so I want to talk about it for a moment. Here's my speculation. Is it possible that someone believed in the White House that an all-out assault by the Marines and the Army on foot going into those treacherous caves with rifles and machine guns fighting the enemy might, even as it was successful, be associated with an Iwo Jima level of casualties? Is it possible that they feared that thousands of combat casualties would affect their ability to persuade the nation to withdraw the troops from Afghanistan and go to invade Iraq instead? I don't know, but I know of no explanation other than that for what happened. And I know this, that on the day when our nation made the decision to invade Iraq, 70% of the American people had been deceived into believing that we were invading a nation that had attacked us. When the greatest nation on the face of this earth lurches into a military adventure on the basis of totally false information, and the American people are brought to believe a falsehood, then it is no wonder that many years later we are still trying to figure out what happened. How did it go wrong? How do we ever get out of there? How do we withdraw? How do we save our honor? How do we save what progress our brave troops have made in spite of all the odds in Iraq? And God bless our troops for the good job that they're doing. We all support them and we're proud of them. But ladies and gentlemen, the nominee of the Democratic Party for President, Barack Obama, before that decision was made, said publicly, "This is a mistake. I'm not against all wars. I'm against dumb wars." And his judgment was correct. And the nominee of the Republican Party, John McCain, was the number one cheerleader saying, "Yeah, let's invade this country. Let's go." And he made a historic mistake. Those two courses of action are directly relevant to the way we judge their respective qualifications to be Commander-in-Chief of the United States of America. And it's another reason why we have to elect Barack Obama. And during the conduct of that war, consider what's happened. Again, you know this, but 31 days from the election, it is time to hold people to account. 230 years ago, at Valley Forge, General George Washington was asked to settle a dispute by two lieutenants, one of whom had captured Hessian soldiers who were fighting, of course, with the British. And as was common in the 18th century, the British and the Hessians had tortured the colonial soldiers that they had captured. And this one lieutenant wanted to return the favor, and the other one said, "No, it doesn't feel right. General Washington, what's your decision?" He said, "Absolutely not, because we stand for something new and different on the face of this earth, the dignity of individuals regardless of their nationality or their origin. We are the United States of America, and we will be born with respect for individuals." And he said, "Were we to torture captives, in General Washington's words, it would bring," and I quote, "shame, disgrace, and ruin to the country to which they were trying to give birth. 230 years passed, and no president violated that prohibition. Of course, in every war there have been excesses and abuses, but never until this administration has torture been devised and mandated and ordered from the White House. It is wrong, and it is time to hold them accountable. We need change. We need to stand up for what's right in this country, for American values. A lot is at stake. Our national soul is affected. I'm telling you, when officials of the executive branch of the government of the United States of America gather in the Situation Room in the basement of the White House, and at the direction of the president, go over individual prisoners' cases on the telephone line to the prisons and talk about which torture techniques are appropriate for which individual prisoner, it is a shame and it is a disgrace to our country, and it is time to hold them accountable. When they violate the law by conducting mass wiretapping of American citizens without warrant as required by the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, it is time to hold them accountable. Honestly, ladies and gentlemen, there's been so much, I can't deal with it. It's gotten to the point where when a new outrage occurs, I've got to download some existing outrage to make room for the new outrage. Are you like that? Any of you had that feeling? You know what I'm talking about? 31 days is the time to deal with it. 31 days and a wake up. The Supreme Court, as many as three Supreme Court justices, may well be appointed in the first term of the president, who is going to be elected in 31 days. And John McCain has said openly that his ideal for appointments will be more Scalias and more Thomases. If you believe that's what we need on the Supreme Court, then that's your choice. But if you want a different direction and Supreme Court justices that will have a philosophy that embodies the kind of attitude toward the United States Constitution that you and I have, 31 days is the time for this decision. Now, I just want to... Healthcare. Can you imagine John McCain wanting to put a tax on healthcare benefits from employers? You know, when national healthcare wasn't adopted in the New Deal, we went to a system of employer-provided benefits. Never have people proposed taxing the healthcare benefits from employers. He's actually proposing that. Education, you know what the difference is. There is. Barack Obama has a visionary plan. But let me talk about just two more issues and then I'm going to close. In the last month, particularly in the last 2 weeks, you and I have had the extraordinary experience of turning on the television news or the radio news or reading the newspapers and hearing and reading statements such as this: this economic crisis may be the worst since 1929. Could be even worse than the Great Depression, when the largest bank failure in the history of the United States, Washington Mutual, is the fourth story in the news. You know that the economy is not in good shape. When seniors are worried about losing their 401ks, when retired workers are worried about losing their pensions, when the stock market is going down, when people are worried about their bank deposits, when those surpluses have been turned into ridiculous deficits, and when they're calling upon the Congress to pass these extraordinary measures because they have because this administration has deregulated and completely failed in its responsibility to keep confidence in the financial system. And the economy has now had its ninth straight month of job losses, 159,000 new people unemployed just in the last month. This economy has been wrecked by their policies. John McCain has supported their policies 95% of the time. Just 2 weeks ago, he said the fundamentals of our economy is strong. He said, you know, economics isn't my strong suit. Ladies and gentlemen, at a time like this, we need a new direction and a president for whom economics is his strong suit. We need Barack Obama as president of the United States. And evidently, farming isn't John McCain's strong suit either, because he opposed Tom Harkin's farm program, and Governor Culver said it very well. And he even opposed Chuck Grassley's measure on promoting wind energy. And you get Chuck Grassley aside quietly. Well, I don't want to get into that. But you know what Jim Leach thinks, because he went to the Democratic convention and said publicly what he thinks. Now, on the economy, Tom Harkin talked about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And when they start pulling out the president of 1929, it's appropriate. And you know, his most famous speech was in his first inaugural, when he said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." I went back a couple of days ago and got that speech and read the rest of it. And I want to give you just a couple of quotes. President Roosevelt said in early 1933, in that first inaugural, "The rulers of the exchange of mankind's goods have failed through their own stubbornness and their own incompetence, have admitted their failure and abdicated. Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. We have always known that heedless self-interest was bad morals. We now know that it is bad economics." Once again, his words are true. And once again, it is time for the kind of sweeping change that the people of this nation brought to America in 1932. Roosevelt went on, and this is a quote you do know, "The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little." Now, finally, both Governor Culver and Senator Harkin, and thank you both for inviting me to come to speak at this dinner, said that I would talk about the climate crisis. I'm not going to talk long about it, but I've got to say just a couple of words about it. In Cedar Rapids, in June of this past year, they took out the maps and looked at the boundaries of the flood. The governor and I were talking about this earlier. The flood exceeded the boundaries of the 500-year flood mark in Cedar Rapids, in Iowa City, in dozens of smaller communities, in 66 of your 99 counties. The flood damage was truly historic. No one has ever seen a flood like this. And I want you to know that all over the world, there are floods that exceed the 500-year boundary. Floods unlike any people have ever seen in these other countries. And I won't go through the list of them. 13 countries in Africa last year, Mexico, England, Indonesia, of course, in the areas like Bangladesh and India, where they have historically had flooding, even there, they have floods beyond what they have experienced in the past. Why? The scientists have warned us for years that the accumulation of global warming pollution in the atmosphere is trapping more of the sun's heat and raising temperatures, and in the process, evaporating more moisture off of the oceans, and the warmer air holds more of the moisture. The average humidity worldwide, everywhere in the world, has gone up dramatically, and when storm conditions present themselves, more rainfall and snowfall falls at the same time, and it causes historic flooding. Tornadoes in Parkersburg, as the governor said. Never in history has an F5 tornado stayed on the ground for 50 miles. This year, the figures are not yet complete, but so far it is an all-time record for tornadoes in the United States. The previous record was just a few years ago. And yes, we've always had tornadoes in Iowa and in Tennessee. 40 of my neighbors were killed not too many months ago. My family and I had to go in our cellar. It didn't come close to our house. It skipped over it. But 40 people in Middle Tennessee, in counties adjacent to ours, were killed. And again, these tornadoes have been known forever. But they're coming more frequently, and they're stronger, and the hurricanes are stronger. And of course, Katrina was the prime example. But let us not forget that no more than 30 days ago, 1 million people were once again evacuated from New Orleans. And in Galveston, there's still people who are suffering and looking for ways to make a new life. We had climate refugees from the Gulf Coast in my brother-in-law's house right next to us in Nashville just this past month for the second time in the last few years. And again, other nations, Haiti was hit by 4 hurricanes. The cyclones and the typhoons, record levels. As predicted, the droughts, the tropical diseases moving into the temperate areas. Here's a new study. University of Tel Aviv, Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences just released a study showing that for every 1 degree increase, there is a 10% increase in lightning strikes everywhere on the surface of the planet. Last month, the new study showed that from 2006 to 2007, there was a 3% increase in 1 year in the global warming pollution emissions. And more than half of it, 53%, is now coming from the developing countries. That is associated with a trend and a track, if it's not interrupted, that would bring an 11 degree Fahrenheit temperature increase in this century. That would bring an end to human civilization. How do we talk about an issue like that in the context of the political system that we know and love? I don't know. I don't know. But I've prayed over it. And I've tried everything I know how to do to find ways to communicate effectively. And I'll tell you this, the world, human civilization, has one hope, and it is the United States of America. And the United States of America, in turn, has one hope, and it is we the people. This is not going to be solved until you, and by the way, you in Iowa have a particularly important role, and everybody flatters you, but it's the truth. I care a lot about this. I wish I could find a way to just communicate directly from what's in my heart about it after studying it for 40 years and after working on it for 30 years to make it take root in your hearts. And some of you, that's already happened. And it's connected to the economic crisis. Let me tell you, this $700 billion rescue plan that we've been talking about, and I thought Senator Harkin dealt with it exactly right when he talked about it. It's not an outlay. Hopefully we'll get a lot of that back. $700 billion. You know what that represents? That's the annual amount of money that we're shipping to foreign countries to burn this dirty oil that comes in from foreign countries. We are spending that much every single year on foreign oil. And we're burning oil and coal, and that's where the global warming pollution comes from. Now we have this economic crisis that needs a solution to stimulate our economy and put people to work, and as Tom says, put money in at the bottom so that it filters up instead of trickles down. What kind of jobs program should we have? What about a jobs program to insulate homes and put in the right kind of windows and light bulbs and build the solar energy panels and the wind power that's built right here in the state of Iowa, one of only two states that builds the towers and the blades and the turbines? You've got an industry of the future here. The national security crisis that I started off talking about, why were they so hell-bent for leather to invade Iraq? Well, there are probably several reasons, you know. And I won't go through all of them, but Saddam Hussein was a bad character, and that's part of it. And George Bush Sr., they tried to kill him, and maybe that entered into the equation somehow. There was maybe a legitimate concern that he might get weapons of mass destruction. I didn't think that was going to happen, but maybe that factored into it. But I think as part of that mix, Vice President Cheney had made speeches time after time before the year 2000, when he was in the oil business, as George W. Bush was before he was governor. Cheney had made speeches saying the only way we can secure our energy future is by ensuring that we can have preferential access to the largest deposits of recoverable reserves of oil in the Persian Gulf, and we need to get busy about it. And there were people who genuinely believed that it was in our national interest to go in there and put military bases to ensure that we would be able to get that oil. Now, if we were not so dependent on foreign oil, we would not have that temptation to get into that kind of strategic blunder anymore. And we wouldn't be fighting wars like that for that reason anyway. So the national security crisis is connected. The debt crisis, the biggest single source of our foreign account, current account deficits, is all this money we're spending for imported oil. The climate crisis, as I said, the trade crisis, all of them have a single thread running right through them. Our ridiculous overdependence on carbon-based fuels that are dangerous and expensive and in places that where the people don't like us. Grab onto that thread and pull it, and all those crises begin to unravel, and you find that you have the answer to every single one of them right in our hands. We need to free ourselves from the dependence, not just on foreign oil, but on carbon-based fuels. We need to go to renewable energy, the sun, the wind, geothermal, conservation, efficiency, jobs here in Iowa, here in the United States. Stop sending the money overseas. Stop polluting the air. Stop destroying the future for our children. Make an investment in the 21st century the way we should. Now let me close. Let me close by saying, as you know, we're borrowing money from China to buy oil from the Persian Gulf and burn it in ways that destroy the future of the planet. Every bit of that has to change. The Stone Age didn't end because of a shortage of stones, and the age of oil won't end when we just run out of oil. It's going to end, the age of oil and coal, when we decide that we can do something better. How do we do it? We need new leadership, and we need to recognize that right now we have leaders that are dependent on these oil and coal reserves, lock, stock, and barrel after barrel. And we need to change that. And we've got a choice on November the 4th that'll take us in a different direction. And not just November the 4th, the early voting has already started here in Iowa. Get out there tomorrow and get your neighbors to start voting now. Get the ballots and start voting now. Not too many years from now, our children are going to look back on the first years of this 21st century. And they're going to look around them 20, 30 years from now, and they're going to ask one of two questions. And I don't know which one it's going to be, but I guarantee you it's going to be one of these two questions. Either they're going to look around and find that the polar caps, the North Polar Cap has melted, and all these terrible consequences that have been talked about and predicted for so long are unfolding, and they're going to ask of us, what in the world were they thinking? What were they doing? Why didn't they act? Didn't they hear the scientists? Didn't they see the ice melting? Didn't they notice the historic 500-year floods? Didn't they notice the tornadoes and hurricanes? Didn't they realize what was unfolding? Didn't they care? Were they too distracted? Didn't they care enough about us to do the right thing? Or they'll ask a second question, and this is the one that I want them to ask. I want them to look back on what we did in this first decade of the 21st century and what we did on November the 4th, 2008. And I want them to ask, how did they find the moral courage to rise and successfully solve a crisis that so many said was impossible to solve? How did they do it? How did they do the difficult? How did they do the unusual? We've got everything we need except political will. But ladies and gentlemen, in the United States of America and in the state of Iowa, political will is a renewable resource. Let's renew it on November the 4th. Let's elect Barack Obama and Joe Biden and Tom Harkin and these Democratic candidates. Thank you very much for having me back. Thank you.